Welcome to the Old Soul Movie Podcast, your number one spot for classic movie rewatches and breakdowns. My name is Jack Oremus, and I'm here with my sister, Emma Oremus. We decided that we wanted to make a show that reflected our love and appreciation for classic movies, and while you're here, hopefully we can share that together as an Old Soul family. We're going to be diving into these movies scene by scene and giving our modern reactions to the films that have influenced generations of people. There will be fun facts, hot takes, tears, laughter, and everything in between. And with that being said, sit back, relax, and enjoy the show.
Ooh, hello and welcome back, everyone, to another episode of the Old Soul Movie Podcast. And tonight, we're going to be covering Psycho, the 1960 classic from none other than Alfred Hitchcock. Emma, how are you doing on this wonderful, spooky October night?
I am so excited to get into one of, if not my favorite, Alfred Hitchcock movies ever. This is certainly in my top three. We have a little midnight recording session going on for the two of us. Yes, this feels like a nice, intimate little murder mystery.
Yes, it's the witching hour, and we have a bunch of candles lit, maybe some nice adult beverages in hand, and we're going to be discussing
water.
And we're going to be discussing a film that I think we've both been looking forward to since we kind of started everything. So very, very excited to cover Psycho. This is definitely one of our favorites. Yeah, I really can't wait to get into it. Emma, what do you think really jumps off the bat first when you think of Psycho?
To me, this is a near perfect movie, if not perfect. I think it is almost without flaw. It is so exciting. It really reinvigorated a genre. And yeah, it's one of Alfred Hitchcock's greatest legacies. So I love it. And what's so exciting as we are covering it right now, this is the 60th anniversary of Psycho's release. Can you believe it? 60 Yeah. years of being blessed with this movie.
Yep. 60 years in about a month, a little over a month, actually. Mm-hmm. September 8th, 1960 was the official release date in the United States. But yeah, this movie is so special. I mean, Jaws made people afraid to go into the ocean, into the water, but Psycho made people afraid to go into the shower, which is such a scary, scary thing to think about. But oh my gosh, what a powerful sort of element of filmmaking or element of suspense, drama, horror, sort of everything. Honestly, I feel like Psycho really covers a lot of mind-twisting things. And you, I mean, the title says it all. I feel like you kind of go on this emotional roller coaster with all of the characters, you know, from the ones at the beginning, the ones in the middle, and the ones at the end. So yeah, this one is very, very special.
It's a beautiful, dark film. So this is categorized as a thriller slash horror film. What's really interesting is that horror movies prior to this focused on fantastical monsters like the Frankensteins, the mummies, the vampires, a la the film we just reviewed. But this was a far more realistic type of monster. And I would argue that this is very much a genre and story-bending experience. What's crazy is it subverts a genre, and then it reinvigorates it at the same time. So it's really fantastic. We go from a getaway story to a murder mystery, and that's very unexpected. And this technique is actually used in the movie Knives Out from 2019, if you're looking for a more accessible modern example of that usage.
Kind of like an opposite, though. I would argue that it's almost like an opposite sort of structuring of a story, but it's still an amazing film. I think everyone should check out Knives Out.
Yes. So this screenplay was written by Joseph Stefano and was based off the 1959 novel of the same name. And this novel was inspired by the case of the convicted Wisconsin murderer and grave robber, Ed Gein. Police found that he created trophies and keepsakes from his corpse's bones and skin. He inspired the characters of Leatherface in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Buffalo Bills in Silence of the Lambs, and obviously the murderer in Psycho. So, a little background on Ed Gein, just because I think it's interesting in the context of this movie and story, is that Ed Gein was also raised in an isolated area by an overbearing mother. His mother would preach that all women except herself were naturally promiscuous and instruments of the devil, which sounds pretty much exactly like Bobby Boucher's mom in the Adam Sandler movie, The Waterboy. And she would punish him every time he tried to make friends. Eventually, his mom died in 1945, and it's said that when she passed, he lost his only friend. And you can definitely see some parallels to that story in this story.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a mother's a boy's best friend.
One of the best lines.
So I'm getting goosebumps right now thinking about Norman Bates. But yeah, I mean, I think one thing that really stands out to me and one thing that I think is definitely worth mentioning is that if you're somebody who prefers modern films, or if you know somebody that prefers modern films and you're trying to get them into watching old cinema, I think this would be a great place to start.
I agree.
Because it is just such a timeless piece, and it really, it doesn't have to rely on the special effects of the modern era, but it utilizes just amazing camera work, and the angles are, I mean, it's just Hitchcock's finest. So you feel almost, I mean, you just feel such a broad range of human emotions when you're watching it due to the cinematography of it. And I think that's something that isn't the main focus of a lot of modern films. I think it's there in some of the, I guess, finer ones, but I think this is a great example of one where it excels. So highly recommend it. And if you're trying to get someone into the genre, why not start with one of the best? And why not start at this time of the year? It's perfect if you can time it and you still, you know, capitalize on the last week of the month here in October. But yeah, I think it's a great one. Emma, what are your thoughts?
No October is complete without a Psycho viewing for me. I think it's a glorious movie. So do you remember the first time you ever watched Psycho?
Vaguely. I mean, we had to be pretty young. I think you watched it before I did, but I also watched it when I was pretty young. I knew about the infamous shower scene, but that was about it. That was about it. And yeah. I was pretty young. So I did not know sort of all the twists and turns that this movie really kind of takes you on. And I think for someone that really doesn't know, that would be a super, super interesting thing to watch with them and just kind of observe their reactions, because I think there's bound to be some great ones. Yeah. What about you?
Okay. So my first Alfred Hitchcock movie ever was Rear Window. And that was one where I'm like, yep, I'm in love with this director. And this movie was the, yep, I want to get married to this director. Like, this was the one that just sealed the deal for me. I loved it. So I had an interesting experience with my first viewing of this. I think I watched it around middle school. And at that time, before I had seen this, I was in a really big Dawson's Creek phase.
I was too. I was as well.
Yeah. And there is, I forget what episode and what season, but in one of the episodes, they freaking show the ending of Psycho. Like, Dawson is watching the end of Psycho and they show the ending, the big reveal in the movie. So I had technically seen the big spoiler before watching the movie. However, what was crazy was it had no impact on me watching this. I was still just as confused and surprised. And that's, to me, shows that you're a master weaver of suspense. If you can see the ending and still be shocked. and thrilled the entire time you're watching it,
yeah,
genius.
I think even on rewatches now, I'm watching it like trying to piece it together still. And that feeling never really goes away to a certain extent. But yeah, I mean, like your kind of anecdote showed, that really is just a sign of a great, great film, mastery of your craft. And Sir Alfred Hitchcock, we tip our hats to you. Emma, what about the production sort of stands out? Or do you want to talk about that? You want to talk about the amazing cast, the amazing performances put in, maybe both?
Let me rattle down the cast really quick and then go through the story of how Psycho almost never was. So We have some absolute legends as part of this cast. We have Anthony Perkins as Norman Bates. We have Vera Miles as Lila Crane. We have John Gavin as Sam Loomis. We have Janet Leigh as Marion Crane. And we have Martin Balsam as Detective Milton Arbogast.
Our listeners will actually recognize Anthony Perkins from Murder on the Orient Express.
As well as Martin Balsam. They acted together in that movie.
Yep. And Martin Balsam was also in... I believe
12 Angry Men.
Yeah, 12 Angry Men and a few other ones.
He's in a bunch.
Yeah, Murder on the Orient Express has both of them. So a fun little reunion for the old soul fam if you're kind of in the trenches with us watching all these movies week in and week out.
What's really fascinating about this cast to me is I think seven actors in this movie were in multiple episodes of The Twilight Zone. So there are seven Twilight Zone alum in this movie, which is really cool. So some background into how Psycho came to be. So Alfred Hitchcock had a lovely, very dedicated, longtime loyal assistant named Peggy Robertson. And she read a very positive review of a book called Psycho. And so she decided to recommend it to Alfred Hitchcock. He ended up acquiring the rights to this book for about $9,500. And then he had his assistant, same Peggy Robertson, buy all the copies of the book so that the ending would be kept a secret from the masses. Now, this was a super stressful time for Alfred Hitchcock. There were other thriller directors out there who were getting just as positive reviews as he was. And he had also abandoned two projects with Paramount, one of which was supposed to be a movie with Audrey Hepburn. And Paramount was just not feeling the idea of Psycho. Their official stance was, quote, that the book was too repulsive, impossible for films, and they did not like, quote, anything about it at all. So that's pretty harsh. And they were like, no. So they ended up, when it was being made, they gave him a much smaller budget than he was used to. And keep in mind that North by Northwest had come out in 1959. It was in color. It had a very substantial budget. I mean, at least a budget enough to cover an airplane crop duster and tons of filming locations, including Mount Rushmore scenes. So that's a pretty extravagant movie, and this is so dialed down from that.
Yeah, the budget being a little under $807,000.
Yeah, that's like going from a steak dinner to being told to get some
fast food. The Golden Corral. We're at the Golden Corral, everyone. So, not to hate on the Golden Corral. I love the fondue like fountain or whatever they have.
Yeah, I was about to like name Wendy's, but I'm like, gosh, I like Wendy's. Like, I don't want to like hate on them.
Someone's got to lose. But right. Yes, the main point, the budget got slashed.
Exactly. So Alfred Hitchcock decided to get a little crafty. He offered to make it in black and white and with his television crew from his show, Alfred Hitchcock Presents. Now, that was rejected too, but eventually a deal was made for him to film at Universal's lot instead of Paramount's. And instead of his usual salary, he would get 60% of the movie's gross. He ended up deciding to personally finance the film if Paramount would distribute it, which was the ultimate deal. This ended up working out really well because it became his highest grossing movie of all time. So he took home quite a bit of money that really paid off for him.
$50 million at the box office for everyone's reference, if you're keeping track, but continue.
Right. So a couple cultural context notes to keep in mind. We have to remember that this was the 60s. There was a huge shift in the film industry because television was becoming so popular. So Paramount didn't really want to take this risk, I feel like. Yet at the same time, because this is really pushing that production code and really getting a little like, ooh, unseen before on the big screen. I feel like to me, that's what helped make this a success because it was so out there and different than what people were used to watching on a screen. Also, I love the screenwriter, John Stefano. He's a really interesting character to me because he was hired even though he had only worked on one film before this one. He also, however, he did work on the show Playhouse 90, which is a show that Rod Serling was a writer for. So I haven't read the book, I'll admit, but I have some notes on it. It's pretty true to the novel. they changed a couple of the characteristics of Norman Bates. For example, Norman is, in the book, is described as being in his 40s, short, overweight, and kind of homely. However, they wanted to make him a little bit more like outwardly likable. So they decided to make him a boy next door. And they cast Anthony Perkins, who was in his 20s, tall, thin,
good looking.
Yeah. So that was kind of their biggest change. They also changed the name Mary Crane to Marion Crane because there were at least one, if not two, real people named Mary Crane living in Phoenix, Arizona, and you don't want to be sued or have any disputes over that.
Right.
And a couple of the murder details were changed to keep the ending more of a surprise. And there was a lot more violence in the book as well as some porn content. So pretty crazy. This movie was just a huge shift in how violence and sex was being shown in a movie, and it changed the game for every other thriller and or horror movie after that. Some would consider this to be the prototype version of a slasher film. This, the 1960 film Peeping Tom, and even the Agatha Christie novel and accompanying movie of the same name, and Then There Were None from 1945, very much influenced the slasher film genre.
So quick question here. All this is happening amidst the production code era. Mm-hmm. So Alfred Hitchcock has to masterfully sort of navigate these waters of possible sex implications, nudity, murder, all these kind of taboo topics that aren't necessarily covered in the wholesome sort of era that, mm-hmm. you know, is trying to be portrayed. How does he go about it that really shows his, for lack of a better word, genius of you know, tiptoeing around the production code? How would you describe that?
A wonderful question with an equally fascinating answer. Alfred Hitchcock and John Stefano worked together to build the script. They put in false scandalous content in there, things that for sure would be like censor alarm bells. We got to take this out. They put that in there with the intention that it would be screened so that it would distract the censor people so that they could keep the other sex and violence in.
You know, that's genius. I mean,
it is brilliant.
Yeah. Kids, if you're taking notes here, maybe apply that to your own life, but I'm going to continue.
We'll point out some examples as this goes through. Yeah, so really quite fascinating. Alfred Hitchcock was very determined to keep the end of this movie a secret to ensure that people were in the theaters at the start of the film. They had the studio provide a record to play in the foyer of the theaters that would say things like 10 minutes to Psycho Time, 5 minutes to Psycho Time, and so on. Could you imagine how cool that would be in a theater in 1960, waiting by the concession stand and having this voice being like 5 minutes? Like, that makes you excited. Like, it makes it a really immersive, full-blown experience even before you're in your seat. The thought that went behind this is just incredible to me. Really amazing. Yes, and like we mentioned earlier, this film is made in black and white for a couple of reasons. A, budget, definitely. B, Alfred Hitchcock thought it would be a little too gory in color. I have to say I like the black and white feel because it feels like a traditional movie. And I don't know whether or not to mention this at the end or right now.
Do it right now.
There is a 1998 remake of this movie. And by remake, I mean it's a shot-for-shot version, line for line, the same movie with just different actors, and it's in color.
If you can believe it, Norman Bates is played by Vince Vaughn, which is mind-blowing.
And that movie might be one of the worst movies I've ever seen, which is crazy because it's actually the same movie, just right. Different people and not in black and white. So to me, further supports that this was a perfectly formulated movie. And if one thing was different, it wouldn't have worked. So yeah, that just goes to show you.
But we digress. Emma, what else about, I guess, pre-production stands out to you or even the actors? Because I feel like the acting in it, like as we're on that note, that
yes.
those it's the part of the system that really makes it work. Because
absolutely.
The performances are just off the charts.
They're some of the best I've ever seen in an Alfred Hitchcock movie. I think this might be my favorite cast, to be honest. So Janet Leigh and Anthony Perkins were kind of your two big names. They were both pretty established actors. So little background, actually, I love this story on Janet Leigh. So Janet Leigh was actually discovered by Norma Shearer in the winter of 1945-1946. Norma Shearer was vacationing at a ski resort in the Sierra Nevada mountains. Norma Shearer noticed a picture of Janet Leigh on her, I think her dad's desk or one of her parents' desk or something. Yeah, and she spotted it. And she's like, who is that girl? And she plucked her out of obscurity and brought her into stardom. And I just think that's crazy. So, and then she, yeah, started acting from there. And Anthony Perkins was really known for his good guy roles. He was definitely known as sweet, wholesome, Jimmy Stewart-esque. And it gets completely exploited in this film, which is absolutely wild.
Yeah. No, I feel like, oh man, there's just so many facets to it that really come together in a beautiful way. What else do you think is extremely important to cover before we sort of dive into the rewatch? We could talk about Psycho for a really long time, everybody. Yeah. I'm sure this won't be the only episode that we do to cover it. I'm sure there will be many more in the future, but what else do you think is essential knowledge before, yeah, a rewatch?
One more quick note is that some people would consider this a ripoff of a 1955 film called Diabolique. And it's also a black and white crime movie, film noir with misogyny and suspense and a murder scene in a bathtub and a twist at the end. So some people think that this is a ripoff of that. Some people just think it was super, super influenced. No matter what, it was definitely influenced. But I'm sorry if you're like hardcore Diabolique fan who's like, this is BS. So yeah, so I hear that complaint. I hear you. I do think this has some merit on its own, and we will point that out as we go through it. This film ended up being a legend. People particularly note that they love how slick the direction is, that there's a perfect amount of tension going on in every scene. If you've ever read a book or read a script, you know that the secret to a good writing is making sure there's tension on every page and there's tension on every scene, which again, done perfectly. Not overdone, not underdone. Great, great camera work, such unique angles. Nothing like I've really ever seen. Gorgeous. And the score. Come on, the score. And of course, the acting. And to me, those are kind of your big components. The writing, the direction, score, camera work, and acting. That's like most of the pie there. So
right. Pretty much all of it. Pretty much all of it.
So the fact that all those had such high praises just solidifies this as one of the most classic movies of all time. One of the best movies of all time. And I just love it. So this movie is actually the fifth and final time that Sir Alfred Hitchcock was nominated for an Oscar for Best Director. He has never won one, or he never won one. Wow. So, but to me, I think this was really deserving. I can't remember who won that year, but I don't know.
Yeah. Winning in the hearts of the people is almost better than winning on paper in a lot of ways.
Some movies were meant to do more than win awards, and this is one of them. So before we get into the rewatch, while filming, Alfred Hitchcock had the cast and crew start every day of work by raising the right hand and promise not to divulge any word of the story. So we're asking you, our old soul listeners, to please raise your right hand and promise you won't spoil any of this or the content of this movie to anyone before they get to watch it.
Everyone in this circle with your little headphones on, or if you're in the car, wherever you are, it stays in the circle of trust, old soul fam.
So before we begin, I want to make this note that there are 10 million reviews out there and analyses of Psycho out there. I wish I could include content from each of those. We're just going to go over kind of the big main ones that you should know while you're watching this film, or things to note while you're watching this film. However, I'm going to be so disappointed in myself because I know I'm going to leave really cool things out. But I encourage you to listen to this and then to keep on pouring through the Wikipedia pages, the different rabbit holes, all the Psycho articles out there. Keep researching it because it has so many fascinating production associations with it and psychological or analytical styles with it. It's just really cool.
Yeah. I mean, we would love nothing more than to keep the dialogue rolling on social media. So if you're, you know, super pumped about the movie, or if you love Psycho, or if you watch it and you're like, oh my gosh, I need to talk about it. Or if, you know, we don't cover anything that you like, then just hit us up on Instagram, Old Soul Movie Podcast. Comment on one of our posts, and then yeah, let's just keep the ball rolling, because we'd love to talk to you guys. We're just gonna have fun with it. You know, it's a fun October spooky season sort of treat, and it's a movie that we love, and I think it's time to get into the rewatch.
Here we go.
All right. So our story begins during a lunchtime tryst in Phoenix, Arizona, at a hotel. Real estate secretary Marion Crane and her boyfriend Sam Loomis discuss how they cannot afford to get married because of Sam's debts. After lunch, Marion returns to work when a client leaves a $40,000 cash payment on a property. Marion's boss asks her to deposit the money in the bank and allows her to leave early after complaining of a headache. Once home, she decides to steal the money and drive to Sam's home in Fairvale, California. Emma, what jumps off the bat to you right at the beginning here?
So we get the Psycho credits rolling. Our first hint that Janet Leigh might not be in this movie for very long and only a feature is that they credit her as Janet Leigh as Marion Crane. Now, sometimes when they do that, that's like the head honcho, like that's right. The big one. But sometimes it is just someone who's
a cameo.
Yeah, a cameo. So that's your first little hint. Saul Bass created the title sequence, and he also did the title design for The 7-Year Itch, that movie that's famous for Marilyn Monroe's skirt blowing up, Vertigo, Anatomy of a Murder, North by Northwest, and West Side Story. Oh, and Goodfellas, and the version of Cape Fear with Robert De Niro, which is so crazy because all the art sequences in those movies have such a similar feel. You can definitely tell the same artist worked on them, even though they're totally different movies. Saul Bass was also the storyboard artist for this film. Like we mentioned in our Rear Window episode, Alfred Hitchcock would use storyboards to design every scene that he did before he directed it so that it would feel very visually focused.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a Stanley Kubrick film. You know what it is when you're watching it. And each one of those title sequences is just so unique and special. And it's not like they're the same, like carbon copy for each one, but they do have that same sort of DNA, like especially Anatomy of a Murder, just because, you know, if again you're following with all the Old Soul sort of movies that we watch, you would know that one, but it has such a similar kind of feel. It's just very like piecey, and I don't really know how else to describe it, but it builds the suspense and sort of really, really sets the tone, I think, for the rest of the movie. And they're always accompanied by great scores.
It's beautiful. Yeah. Speaking of which, this score is amazing. We mentioned it in our Music in the Movies episode. Bernard Herrmann, absolutely prolific and brilliant composer. He composed the score for this movie. You'd recognize his musical work from Citizen Kane, The Trouble with Harry, The Man Who Knew Too Much, A Hat Full of Rain, The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, Vertigo, North by Northwest, and Taxi Driver, which is another really well-known score. What's unique about the score is that it's played entirely by string instruments, mimicking the black and white colors of the film and sort of that black and white good and evil feel. This is just kind of a little like note here as you're watching the film. While you watch this movie, make sure you recognize how the score amps up every time someone does something either subjectively bad or overtly bad. So for example, Sam and Marion hooking up, that might be a little like, ooh, like dicey. When she steals the money, that's also a little bit like, I don't know. When the murder finally happens, you're getting full-blown strings there. So the intensity of the music matches the intensity of the event and its quote-unquote badness.
Yeah, I can hear that music right now, that that really sharp, abrupt, like, dun-dun. Don't.
Everyone knows it.
You know, like it's perfect. And yeah, I feel like this is a great, great setup and a totally believable motive for Marion. Very real. Again, like you mentioned, it's not some sort of fantasy monster like Frankenstein or our good friend Dracula and Christopher Lee, who we dearly love from last week. But, you know, a very real sort of problem that could easily happen in society in our lives. And so I think that really sets us up and really kind of makes us empathize a little bit with Marion in a way. Like,
right.
I mean, she's not desperate maybe, but
pushed.
Yeah. And I mean, I love the interaction at the real estate sort of company,
yeah. Where,
especially with whoever the other woman is with like the, he must have saw the ring on my finger.
Sure, Jan.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that was a great line. Had to put that in there, but.
This came out in 1960, and this feels like a new decade to me. This looks like the new Hitchcock era to me. It feels relatively more modern in comparison to his 50 films, the ones that just came out. Yeah, we're definitely new in a new decade. And I love the very beginning. I love the slices of shots that zoom in. It's not just one camera pan. It slices, again, that cutting feeling. We see Sam and Marion on the bed. He's shirtless. She's in a bra. Very, very risque. And this is our first taste of the consistent Hitchcock theme of voyeurism that we discussed again in Rear Window. Now, Sam says he can't get married because he's paying off his dad's debts and he's paying alimony to his ex-wife and he's just way too broke to get married. So at first you think, ooh, they're having an affair. But then the real reason comes out that they can't be together. And you're like, oh, that's not even that bad. Emotionally, the audience is meant to sympathize with their struggle. And side note, if you're wondering how this long distance relationship came to be, the backstory in the novel is that they met on a cruise. So yes, we go to the real estate office. Hitchcock has his cameo. He is wearing a Stenson hat outside the office. You can spot him pretty easily. Mm-hmm. So he actually chose to do his cameo so early because he didn't want people to be distracted from the plot because he knew people would be on the lookout for him because he makes a cameo in every movie. So very cool. Now, the coworker, that coworker of Marion's is played by Pat Hitchcock, who is Alfred Hitchcock's daughter. And her tranquilizer comment, oh my goodness, what an interesting social commentary given the context of the time period, like this sort of women having to be sedated to get through their marriages. That's insane. Right.
But I believe it. I believe it though.
Oh yeah, no, it's very intriguing. And then we get introduced to that, you know, rich guy with the money. So this is fascinating because he says things like he doesn't declare his money. That's how he keeps it and stuff. Now, in this situation, our protagonist is put in a situation that makes us feel bad for her. The guy that she eventually steals money from has a crime committed against him. But because he's shown hitting on her, overstepping his boundaries, bragging about his money, and even saying that he could afford to lose $40,000.
Yeah.
We don't feel bad for him when a crime is committed against him. And weirdly enough, we're then turned into a position where we're rooting for her to succeed. And then we're in this, will she get away with it story? It's a really crazy psychological technique to get you on this side of someone who commits the crime versus the person who is the crime victim.
Yeah, right.
Also, little note, this is one of those parts, the rich guy says something about Las Vegas. This is one of those instances originally in the script. He says something like that bed is the second best playground after Vegas. And that was one of those scandalous lines that was thrown in there to be taken out so that they could keep some other dicey stuff. So pretty cool. Great play on Stefano and Hitchcock's part for art's sake.
Right.
Next, we get into that scene where she decides to steal the money. And this, again, very visual movie, folks.
Accompanied by a great, I mean, we already talked about the score, but the score really, really complements it because she's the only sort of actor in the scene. So
right.
It's like, it's kind of like the music sort of mimics her thinking.
Yes, it's like its own character.
Yeah, definitely.
So in this next scene, she decides to steal money. Now, let's note some of the symbolism. Now she is wearing a black bra and has a black purse. This symbolizes her doing something on the more immoral side. Notice that in the scene with Sam earlier, she had a white bra on and was carrying a white purse, making her look a little bit more angelic and innocent. This is where we get some of that amazing camera panning to tell a story, which is a similar technique that we got in Rear Window. So for example, in Rear Window, we have the opening scene and it goes from Jeff's broken leg to the photos of his wild adventures and then his accompanying camera. And then we can go like, wow, okay, we can deduce that this guy leads a pretty reckless life. In this instance, our shot goes from the money to her suitcase, which lets us put two and two together that she's planning on running away. It's a cool technique of visually delivering information without using any words or actions for that matter.
Right.
So it's really cool. I just love it. I love that.
Yeah.
A little bit of a wardrobe note for the rest of the movie for Janet Leigh. Her clothes were actually not custom made for her. They were actually bought off the rack from regular clothing stores. Alfred Hitchcock wanted women who were watching this to identify with her and feel like it was clothes that someone like themselves would actually wear and that they could actually afford, adding to make it even more realistic and hit close to home.
Yeah, there's a difference between that perfectly tailored fit and sort of the slightly off feeling of maybe off the rack. So
yeah, this isn't Edith Head.
Yeah, that's just an excellent directorial choice. For a little bit of context for the modern listener, $40,000, the amount of money that was given to our dear Marion from the scumbag of a man in this cowboy hat, whatever, would be the equivalent to around $351,000 in today's monetary terms. So you can understand why she would be a little bit paranoid maybe about just having this amount of cash on her and just laying on the bed and sort of going back and forth between, you know, the devil and the angel on the shoulder, that whole sort of ordeal. But yeah, I think that the tension is excellently sort of escalated throughout this. It's not too dramatic. It's not too, you know, subtle. It's really just right.
It's so good. And that you know what's so funny? I'm glad you mentioned it because I look it up every year, what the monetary value would be. And I feel like it just goes up and up every year.
I mean, it does. It does. So
crazy.
I mean, it's important to note because it can kind of get lost in sort of the generational divide, maybe.
And that's a lot of money to me right now.
I would love it if we could just dub whatever that number is every year, 357, right? You know, but yeah, so.
Well, she gets out of town and when she sees her boss, it's like, oh no, it's such a simple yet effective shot. And notice the music picking up, actually the most it has picked up in this point in time.
Right, right. It's just, and I guess as the audience member, you don't necessarily know if something's wrong until that music hits because her face is pretty, it's like, oh, hey. And then it dawns on her like, oh, wait, like he sees me and I'm not home, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think that is really, really where we start to, you know, have the apropos title come into play.
It's amazing. So what happens next?
So en route to Fairville, Marion stops her car on the side of the road and falls asleep. She is awakened the next morning by a California Highway Patrol officer. She is nervous, and the officer decides to follow her. Marion stops at a Bakersfield automobile dealership and trades in her car, which has Arizona license plates, for a new vehicle with California plates. The officer watches her suspiciously as she drives away.
First of all, that highway scene with the cop pulling up to talk to her.
The entire interaction.
Oh my gosh. She's acting so suspicious. I love how she's like, does it seem like I'm acting if something is wrong? And I love how he's like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It definitely taps into your own psychology of guilt and worrying about doing something wrong or being caught. Mm-hmm. And even a little bit of personalized criminogenic thinking, because you're kind of like, you want her to get away with this money. You want her to succeed. I don't know. It's really dynamic. And what's really fascinating is that this cop advises her to sleep in a motel instead of on the side of the road. We'll see how that advice works out for her later. But then Marion gets her new car. She goes see California Charlie, who's played by John Anderson, a terrific character actor.
Oh, yeah, great, great.
I thought this was a really fun fact when I was doing some research. The car dealership in this movie is Harry Maher's used car lot, which is near Universal Studios. Now, Ford, the car company, was a sponsor of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, the TV show. So the cars in the movie have just beautiful Fords, Edsels, and Mercurys, because they were sponsoring Hitchcock. So I think that's really interesting. Next time you watch it, there's some advertising.
Yeah, I mean, they're beautiful cars. I can't deny that. Plus, I mean, it's what, $700 with a trade-in? I mean, thinking about that deal today is absurd. But I mean, I think the thing that really stands out to me in this sequence is the camera shots between the police officer and Marion. Those tight close-ups are just money. Like, it perfectly builds sort of the, I guess, internal state that those characters might be experiencing, especially Marion. I feel like the cop is just kind of like, what did I just, you know, step into here? But I think it really makes you so anxious.
Yeah. I mean, between the camera work and the dialogue, there is a lot of great setup to destabilize this character. For example, one of my favorite lines is when California Charlie goes, "First customer is always trouble." And you know what? There is definitely some truth to that. I feel like whenever I've had an emergency of sorts or needed something right away, I am the first one at that store as soon as it opens. And I'm not there unless it's an emergency. Mm-hmm. So, and I love that that sets her off. I also love the line of first time a customer ever, high pressure salesman.
that's a great line. So true. That's a great line.
So I would totally think that she stole that car myself. She is acting extremely suspicious. It's a great feeling of suspense. Again, the music is helping you. It's cueing a sense of wrongness. She has to do everything so seedily. She's in the bathroom. Again, we have this very obsessive focus on the money thanks to the directing and camera work. Even the very ends of her visit there, when you get that, hey, you think, oh no, she's caught. And she thinks it too. It's a very parallel process experience between you and the character. And in fact, she just forgot her bags. She's not being taken in or anything. I am shocked that that police officer didn't keep following her. And I'm even more shocked that she actually went through with it and didn't go to a new car dealership, because I feel like her getting that new car and having the police officer there completely defeated the purpose.
Right. Because the police officer saw her, you know,
yeah, and anyway. Her new plates. Anyway, right. Whatever. The following scene of her driving at night, it's getting darker. You're descending deeper into the darkness of her mind. The conversations in her head are amazing. I feel like that is such a relatable experience. Even if you haven't had conversations like that where you're imagining what people are saying, you've had that sort of rumination or worry. And this is definitely a good example of what that can sound like. And at this point, I remember the first time I watched this. This is the point where you start to think, she's the psycho. Might be the crazy one.
Exactly.
Which is really cool, because at this point I'm like, oh, she's losing it. You feel tension while you're watching it. It just translates great from screen to your body.
Yeah, I think that her facial acting too. I mean, one thing, you're listening to this dialogue between all these characters in her head, but then her eyes are just like, it's paralyzing. I don't even know how to describe it.
Well, when I was watching it, I'm like, I feel like I've made those eyes. Like, I've been there.
I'm somewhat dead inside, but I'm also on high alert.
Yeah.
It's a really kind of, I don't know, weird experience. But I mean, she just completely nailed it. So again, just, you know, tip the cap to that acting. Yeah. Anything else to add before we move on?
No, it sounds like we're on our way to the Bates Motel.
Oh, yes, we are. So during that rainstorm that you mentioned, Marion stops for the night at the Bates Motel, and she hides her stolen money inside of a newspaper. The proprietor, Norman Bates, invites her for dinner after check-in. She accepts his invitation, but overhears an argument between Norman and his mother about bringing a woman into their Gothic home, which sits perched above the motel. Instead, they eat in the motel parlor, where he tells her about his life with his mother, who is mentally ill, and forbids him to have a life apart from her. Here we go.
Okay, so first thing to note, she's pulling up. Interestingly enough, the music stops when she gets there. Mm-hmm. Now, because of the earlier scenes with the score, you think, oh, thank God, she's safe because the music stopped. And so far, the music has been associated with bad things. So it has this opposite effect in your mind where you think it's good when the music stops. And it's a little bit of a false sense of security. It makes it fun. It's like a roller coaster. And Okay, so the Bates House, brilliant set work. It was modeled after an oil painting called House by the Railroad, painted in 1925 by Edward Hopper. And it is now, or at least it was, in the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. I believe it's still there now. Yeah, so the architecture, the viewpoint, the sky, it's almost the exact same as this movie. I looked at the picture. They look so similar. It's amazing how they recreated it. It's absolutely crazy. Oh, and also the Bates House was moved from its original location, but it's still at the Universal lot and has been replicated. And it's a stop on the Universal Studios tram tour if you're interested in seeing it yourself.
Great time.
So there's this house in the motel. I show up. I think it looks like a nice enough place. What are your thoughts? You think this looks like a cool place where you could stay for a night?
I mean, that's a pretty gnarly rainstorm. If I'm driving in that, I'm definitely pulling over and maybe even heeding the advice of the California Highway Patrol officer. But important to note, it's sort of off the road, which Norman also sort of, I guess, reinforces with their little conversation later. But I think one of the greatest parts about this this scene is sort of the POV nature of the camera, where mm-hmm. you're kind of looking through the windshield and you're looking kind of how your eyes would naturally track like the signage of the motel,
right, and
along with the rain and sort of the quaint nature, maybe, because mm-hmm. it's like it's a single kind of flat motel. It's nothing right. like It's nothing fancy.
But it's cute. I think yeah. it looks cute.
Yeah. And, you know, maybe there's some weird house at the top of the hill, but I'm not really thinking about that. I'm thinking, you know, I just want to shut my eyes for the night and get on my way with stealing this money if I'm. And so I personally would not think anything is amiss at this point, but we will see what happens later on.
Okay. So then we have Norman Bates show up, and he is just about the most adorable, most charming, welcoming guy in the entire world. I remember the first time I watched this, I was like, I love Norman Bates. I was like, in the first scene, I was like, he is cute as a button. I love this kid. Even when he's like 12 vacancies, no one ever comes here anymore. It's just cute. Now, we were just told that there's 12 vacancies. And as an audience, when he's about to get a key for her, we think, okay, he can pick any one of those keys. Why is this decision hard? His hand is like kind of hovering a bit. There's a pause. And then he gives her key number one, and he explains that cabin number one is the closest to the house. So if she needs anything, she's right there. And you're like, oh, that was so sweet and thoughtful. So you're reassured. Mm-hmm. It's amazing how micro these details are laid in there to reassure your mind, to like set you up as scared and then to reassure you. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely insane. It's genius. And when he's showing her around the room, he's just so bashful and adorable. And he can't even say the word bathroom, which I feel like kind of reflects the feeling of censorship that people were coming out of. Like, she was so cool saying bathroom and he wasn't. And audience members might be like, oh my gosh, did he just like recognize a bathroom?
They said the B word.
The B word. And so far, I feel like I could trust this guy with my life. And again, we get tons of preoccupation with that stack of cash. And as an audience member, you're supposed to still be fixated as well. It's just getting so much attention. And now this is kind of where, again, a good story has ups and downs. And we just came up from an up. She's in a safe haven with a good guy, it seems like. Now we have a little bit of a down spike. And we overhear Norman and his mom fighting about her. And she's also sounding like Bobby Boucher's mom in The Water Boy. And you're like, who is this lady? So what are your thoughts listening to this conversation?
I mean, right off the bat, I think that this woman is just straight batshit crazy. I mean, you feel bad for Norman because I feel like you don't really understand the circumstances for why he's there, but it's just something that he kind of has to put up with. And yeah, I mean, it's clearly two voices if you're Marion. So it sounds like it's a normal conversation and nothing is amiss. But again, you feel in the moment bad for Norman Bates because he's got to deal with this woman and she's just so cranky. But yeah, I mean, you are definitely intrigued by Norman to a certain extent. You want to learn more about him because you can feel like, you know, maybe mm-hmm. he's that weird kid yeah, it doesn't seem too off until we sort of get into the parlor room where we see sort of his interesting hobbies.
Yes, he's a taxidermist, which to us non-taxidermists, it's very frightening. But okay, so I have a quick question. Mm-hmm. Did any part of you think it was weird when Norman wouldn't go into Marion's room to eat? Like the first time you watched this or even watching this with just like a fresh set of eyes this time?
It definitely is strange because, I mean, he audibles twice. Like first it's his room and then secondly it's his office because it's too officious. And so, you know, it's like he was trying, I don't know if he was trying to get her into his sort of parlor room with all these birds, but yeah, it definitely was strange. What about you?
I feel like the first time I watched this, because of him just talking to his witch of a mother and seeing how sweet he is, I felt like he was just really shy and just felt like he didn't want to intrude on her space the first time I watched this, my first instance of me seeing that scene. So I figured it was him being modest. We'll see how that changes in like 5 minutes. But yeah, so he's in this parlor and like you mentioned, there's a big bird theme going on. There's a line about birds and this one about eats like a bird is actually a fallacy. Birds actually do eat a lot. Norman Bates is right on that. And the camera angles are incredible. Yeah. I love the birds in the background. So what's symbolically interesting for this, a lot of people have done analysis on this, is that there's an owl, a crow, and a hoopoe in the background. And these birds are associated with wisdom and or intelligence. And there's also a pheasant, which is known for its stupidity. So a lot of people think that this parallels a dual nature in Norman. Now, there are several references to birds in this movie also, such as Marion's surname being Crane, the taxidermy birds, and also it might be a little hint that Alfred Hitchcock's next movie will be The Birds in 1963. So that could be some Taylor Swift foreshadowing, clue hinting there.
Dropping the next album, yes.
And there's some amazing lines, such as a son is a poor substitute for a lover, and well, a boy's best friend is his mother. Yeah, those are very iconic lines, very frightening, very much highlighting creepy. That Oedipus complex.
Yeah.
Like who could you imagine saying that? Like I would never put lover in my parents' name in the same sentence or, you know, I don't know.
I can't think like that necessarily. It's just, yeah.
So it's supposed to sound weird.
Right.
So this is intriguing. I just mentioned a duality in his nature, and we see two very different sides of Norman in this instance. We get a very meek guy who feels stuck in his life and just kind of trapped. But then when Marion suggests put her in some place.
Yeah. Then,
this other side of Norman gets threatened and becomes more aggressive back at her, and it scares you a little as an audience. Mm-hmm. Like you thought this guy was all fun and games, and then you just got a little ooh. But enough has been built where it doesn't last. It's really incredible. Like I said, the camera shots are amazing. They have different angles. You're looking at Norman from below. You're looking at him from above. You mm-hmm. have her positioned higher, and then you have him getting on the same level, all to illustrate a power struggle going on with both of them mentally. And yeah, so very great for the visual learners.
Yeah, the power dynamics can so easily be manipulated by the angles. And I feel like that's something that I wish I saw. I mean, it's there in modern movies, but I think this is exemplary in how mm-hmm. it really does that. And I mean, yeah, again, the dynamic shift while the scene's going on. And I think that's great that you can see it while it's happening. You see the birds of prey sort of in a hunting sort of position, like in mm-hmm. flight, you know, like ready to pounce.
I do love the line of we all go a little mad sometimes when he's talking about his mother. And it's an interesting line because Marion and the audience feels that. We've all had moments of, wow, I just lost it a moment, just had a little mm-hmm. craziness. And Marion just had a little moment of craziness. And her stealing the money probably was out of character. And she probably did feel very pushed in that moment. And it seems like having this little talk inspired her to go back and fix the situation.
Exactly.
we think that there's going to be some redemption for her.
So, having said that, Marion is moved by Norman's story, and she decides that she is going to drive back to Phoenix the next morning to return the stolen money. While in the shower later that night, a shadowy figure stabs her to death. After seeing the blood, Norman panics and runs to Marion's room, where he discovers her body. He cleans up the crime scene, putting Marion's corpse, including, unbeknownst to him, the stolen money, into the trunk of her car and sinking it into the swamps near the motel.
Okay.
Here it
is. So this is probably the most famous scene in the movie. So how do we get here in terms of story building? Technique-wise, first we get a little bit of a disjointment. She says her last name is Crane, and you go, oh no, it's different than the fake name she put in the guest book. So there's a little bit of a sense of betrayal there, and you're worried that he's going to find that out. Notice that this is the first time that Hitchcock has left us alone with a stranger without Marion. Not a stranger, we know him, he's Norman. But this is the first time he's left us with someone who isn't Marion. And we're kind of like, that's my friend. Wait, Marion, come back. Don't leave me with a stranger. But we have an interest and a slight bond with the character of Norman, because we did see a pretty substantial scene with him. So we've built a little bit of a bond. So then the creepy stuff happens, and Norman takes down a painting of Susanna and the Elders, which is a painting of two old men spying on a woman and then attempting to rape said woman as she bathes. So that's already a little bit of a symbolic story in a story. And then there's a peephole moment, and it makes you go like, ooh, this guy is super weird.
Yeah.
And then your mind goes back to the cabin number one key, and you're like, I wonder if that's why he picked it. Like, oh my God. I love this scene from a technical standpoint for so many reasons. The camera that's used to show his point of view looking at Marion is done with a circular mask over the lens. Alfred Hitchcock actually used a 50 millimeter lens on his 35 millimeter camera. And this actually gives you the closest approximation to human vision possible. So it feels like you're actually there watching this, especially the scene when he's spying on her. It feels like that's actually you looking at her, not a camera. So it feels like his eye. So really creepy. And then he goes back into his house, and it's a weird feeling you're left with, because you've started to sympathize with this guy because he seems bored and lonely and frustrated that he has to go home to his awful mother. But at the same time, he just spied on our homegirl. So it's this feeling.
You're torn, almost.
Yeah, it's not totally unexpected, because we did get to know him pretty well from that lengthy conversation. And in fact, we got to know him better than Sam at this point in time, really, more than any other non-protagonist. So naturally, this starts to be the new person we either want to succeed or at bare minimum are just curious about and wouldn't mind seeing more of. Yeah, then this is a very historical scene. She throws her writing down the toilet. First time a toilet is seen being flushed in an American film. Yeah, pretty fascinating. The screenwriter, Joseph Stefano, was pretty determined to get this toilet flushing scene because he wanted this to feel as realistic as possible. Could you imagine having all your TV content not show any bathroom, which you obviously spend in real life, and then to see these people actually in a bathroom? I don't know how to explain it other than if I just put myself in that mindset.
Yeah, you're finally seeing reality sort of on the big screen.
Right.
And, which makes it more real.
Right.
You know, and so, which makes the entire scene that much worse.
And that hasn't gone away. Like, we all still use bathrooms today. So yeah, I think that's why it's still impactful, because.
Yeah. Exactly.
We all spend time in a shower or whatever. Mm-hmm. So then the famous shower scene happens.
I mean, let me just paint the picture here.
Yes.
I mean, there is nothing, in my opinion. I mean, this is one of the scariest scenes, regardless of any movie that's
what
come
are
out.
Your What are your first reactions watching this?
The camera work is unparalleled, with just, you know, being in the shower. And every single shower I take, I don't want to say every single one, but most showers, you know, when my eyes are closed, I'm thinking this. Where if I don't close the door, or if maybe I do, it's getting locked, because that moment where you see that door swing open and that shadowy gray figure just start coming closer to the shower curtain. I'm getting chills right now thinking about it. Like, that is one of the scariest moments, like, in all of cinema. It is unreal.
The blurred figure obscured by the shower curtain, to me, is one of the scariest parts in this whole film. And maybe it's because you see like the actual kind of stabbing part, like in trailers and stuff, or just in pictures.
I gotta like look behind myself right now, just like, to make sure I'm good.
Exactly. But knowing that the danger is there, like, oh my gosh, I think that's what was so amazing to me the first time I watched this, was because I wasn't expecting the buildup. I was expecting the knife, you know, we're all expecting that, but I didn't know how it was going to happen. And that was really scary.
That balance between just hearing the shower going, you know, no music. And then, you know, that infamous classic score.
The strings.
the haunting strings. I mean, you hear it, you know it, and it's game over. So, give me the fun facts. Give me, you know, we've made it scary. Let's make it light. If we can do that.
Right. Well, other observation, when I watch the scene, what's so crazy is I see so much of Jamie Lee Curtis's face in her mom during this scene in particular. It's wild. And maybe it's because they're screaming and Jamie Lee Curtis is a famous scream queen. But yeah, Jamie Lee Curtis is, of course, the daughter of Janet Lee and Tony Curtis. Tony Curtis is, of course, in Some Like It Hot. He was also in Spartacus, which also starred John Gavin, who played Sam Lewis.
Also the ambassador to Mexico from 1981 to 1986, I believe.
Yes, yes, he was. John Gavin's a cool guy. Jamie Lee Curtis was in the movie Halloween, which really propelled the slasher film genre forward. They were excited that she was going to be in that movie because she was Janet Lee's daughter, who was so famous from her stabbing death in this movie. Halloween, actually, crazily enough, has a character named Sam Loomis after this character. And do you know who was offered the part of Sam Loomis in that movie, the Halloween movie first?
I do not.
Peter Cushing.
Wow.
And
our new favorite Peter Cushing. My gosh.
I think his agent turned it down. But yeah, so wild stuff there for anyone looking for some cross references between Halloween and Dracula.
And horror of Dracula and Psycho, you know.
Right. You
know, we're connecting the dots, y'all.
Okay, so to the fun facts. This scene was originally supposed to happen without music, but Hitchcock was so convinced by Herman's score that this was the right move to include it. Yeah, originally it was supposed to be just water, shower curtain opening, screams, and stabbing. No music. Now, I think that it personally would either have to go score or complete dead silence. Like, you don't even hear anything. Like, it's on mute. Because to me, that would mimic trauma, like when you black out or white out. Mm-hmm. Because you just can't hear anything.
Plus, it's scarier because your mind is interpreting, you know, all that happening.
So, very cool. But I'm glad that they did include the strings. I agree that was the right move. The sounds of the strings really mimic knives slashing. So, we don't ever see the knife pierce her skin ever. But because we have the music, it's a synesthesia experience where the sound produces an image that we don't actually have there.
But you feel it.
Yeah, actually, just like, it's really cool. It crosswires your senses. Also, for the shot looking up at the water stream coming down from the shower head, Alfred Hitchcock had a 6-foot diameter shower head made and then blocked the central jet so that the water sprayed in a cone past the camera lens without any water going onto the camera lens. Which is a lot of dedication to get that shot. Could you imagine a 6-foot shower head?
I love it. I mean, that's amazing.
Like a basketball player. Yeah, that's huge. Yeah. Also, Alfred Hitchcock used Bosco chocolate syrup instead of blood. To me, obviously, like, what blood would you be using? Like chicken blood? Because it shows up better on camera. And I think that's really cool. The sound of the knife cutting the flesh. Yeah. Stabbing a melon. Mm-hmm. pretty wild. Janet Leigh wore moleskin adhesive patches to cover her private parts as she acted in the shower scene so she wouldn't show up nude. I actually am still trying to figure out how this made it past the censor. Even if you put in like all the most fabulous naughty lines in the world, that's like...
I have no idea how this made it past the censors, honestly. Because she still does look completely naked.
Yeah, and she's pretty like, nude.
Yeah, and it's still somewhat of a gory scene, even though
right.
you know, we don't see actual knife penetration of flesh.
Right.
It's about as accurate maybe or as close as you're going to get back in the day. And I have no idea either. I really don't.
Wild. So crazy. So this movie had such a hubbubaloo with this scene. Alfred Hitchcock actually got a letter from an angry father whose daughter refused to take a bath after seeing the bathtub murder in Diabolique and then refused to take a shower after seeing this movie. So Alfred Hitchcock sent back a note simply saying, send her to the dry cleaners, which I think has got to be the sassiest response ever. I love that he's just like, oh, no, like that's your problem.
Yeah, he didn't have to respond for the record, but I mean, he still went out of his way to make a little like sly comment. I love that.
Yeah, amazing sense of humor. So oddly enough, Janet Leigh did not feel bothered by filming the shower scene, but when she saw it in the movie itself, she said that it made her realize how vulnerable women are when they shower, and then she only took baths for the rest of her life.
That is unbelievable.
Hopefully she hasn't seen Diabolique. I would maybe stay away from that one.
Those are a lot of smelly women in the world from watching Diabolique and Psycho.
I feel like if I had watched this in 1960 when it came out, I would do like a sponge bath. Like I would just like soak my sponge.
I mean, I do that now after watching it. Jeez.
So crazy. And you know what's weird is I was watching this, obviously, and when he's looking at her through the peephole, she goes to the the right of her. And I think she goes out of view, I think she's going to lock the door, which makes it even scarier because the hotel manager has the key.
Right.
And can unlock it. Oh my gosh. Just, yeah, really, really. Blah.
Terrifying.
Yeah. Anyway, so now she's dead. And I love the close up on her eye. Again, we get that theme of voyeurism. Mm-hmm. Fun fact, a lot of ophthalmologists wrote to Hitchcock after seeing this film to let him know that pupils dilate after death and that you can do this with belladonna drops, which he used for the rest of his films. It's the only imperfect thing in this movie to me. I think every time I watch it now, I'm like, I just wish we could CGI the pupils to be dilated. That'd be kind of cool.
That along with the changing monetary value of the 350 of it.
You know? I think that Alfred Hitchcock would be okay with that CGI change if it was just that. I think, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I think that'd be cool. And again, we get the same camera panning technique to tell a story or read between the lines. It goes from her dead body to a shot of the money explaining, look, this is how she got into this mess. Over money to the house. And then once we get to the house, we hear Norman shocked at the blood and he shouts, mother, oh God, blood, blood. And what's really cool is Alfred Hitchcock had the bass frequencies removed from his voice, from his dialogue track to make him sound more young and more scared. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So really cool. And so then we get into one of the most another great tension-filled scenes when he comes in to find Marion stabbed to death. This is a huge shock because, A, your protagonist has just been killed off, and as a viewer, you can feel very betrayed or it can feel very shocking to your system. B, you now identify with feelings of guilt and shame when Norman is trying to cover up for his mom and clean up the scene. And our sympathies have been built up enough to hope that he succeeds in his tasks, no matter how shady it is, mimicking our experience with Marion stealing the money and trying to get away with it. So now we've flip-flops. Now we've kind of latched on as little leeches to Norman Bates as the guy that we're hoping gets away with it, even though it's not his crime, technically, so to speak. So it's amazing how quickly you root for people to get away with not so great things in this movie. And it's because it's artfully crafted for you to feel that way. It really gets into the darker parts of the self. It's crazy. And it is extremely creepy at how proficient he is at cleaning up this crime scene, which makes me think, did he do this before? And if so, how many times? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, he seems to have his little routine set up here. I mean, bucket check, mop check, you know, I mean, taking down the shower curtains check, you know, wrap her up like Dexter or whatever check. Yeah, definitely a few, I guess, red flags are immediately being raised.
Well, cued by the score, it's amping right. up.
Cued by the score. It's all great because the score has to, you know, speak for all the aspects that we're missing, like no dialogue. So yeah, it's all actions, all music. It's a great scene just because, yeah, I mean, it's not like he is, you know, taking his time with wondering what he should do next. He just knows. And so he just, right. just does it. And so I think that is something that might not register until maybe like a second watch. Cause like I could easily see myself saying like, oh, he must be running on adrenaline, blah, 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 blah.
Right. You make excuses for
yeah,
him.
Exact. Yeah. Which is really strange. And I don't know what that says about the human psyche, but, but yeah, I mean, him sort of cleaning up this entire mess and then ultimately going to the swamp. The swamp scene is one of the best scenes, one of my favorite scenes because it's kind of comedic. Like the car stopping halfway through and then he just kind of looks around like, oh my God. And then boom, continues to sink. But yeah, I mean, the entire cleanup scene is great.
Yeah, there are great moments of thrills, like when he's collecting all the things and then there's like a car goes by, you see some car headlights and it's like, well, stop what you're doing. And
yeah,
then
drop.
So I, when he's in the swamp, I love the choice of no score here. Originally, there was a score written specifically for the swamp scene. I think it was called Swamp. And I like that they didn't use it because it made it feel more realistic. I could put myself in those shoes of,
I'm trying to sink this car, you know?
Yeah. Like, oh my gosh, why isn't it going down? What am I going to do? It made it feel really close to home. And I think it demonstrates pure mastery as a filmmaker when you can edit yourself, even when you have something really good and phenomenal, like the score of this film, when you can take that out and know that it's going to be effective there, to me, you're an artist. Mm-hmm. So also notice that we get one last highlight of the disguised money. And you know what? It ended up not mattering and it all sinks in the swamp with her, just like her character, I guess, kind of. We were so focused on both her and the money and they both end up just being tossed away.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think this is great cinematography, great lighting, given the fact that it's in black and white. I mean, that mixed with the sound design of the swamp with all these kind of like late night creature sounds and the nervousness of sort of like the shadows that you can see on Norman's face, kind of seeing him in a different light, like literally darker. And so, yeah, I think that it's a great sort of little metaphor for the shift that we're seeing in the story. It's like, okay, now really, how do we feel about this guy? And it really sets up, I think, the second half of the movie very beautifully.
Absolutely. Yeah. So then what happens next? Our protagonist is dead. What's going on?
Kind of the similar situation that we found ourselves in with the horror of Dracula last week. A week later, Marion's sister Lila arrives in Fairvale and confronts Sam about Marion's whereabouts. Private investigator Milton Arbogast approaches them and confirms that Marion is wanted for theft. Arbogast traces the local motels and discovers that Marion spent a night at the Bates Motel. He questions Norman, whose stammering and inconsistent answers arouse suspicion. Norman refuses to allow Arbogast to speak with his mother. Arbogast updates Sam and Lila about his search for Marion and promises to phone again soon. He goes to the Bates home, searching for Norman's mother, and at the top of the stairs, a shadowy figure stabs him to death.
Wow, wow, wow. Okay, so we transition out of the crime cleanup scene and the conversation that we eavesdrop on at the hardware store is amazing. The content on extermination and that it should always be painless, there's a lot laden in that little speech there. For one, it distinguishes a normal person's views from a quote-unquote psycho's view. And it's a really appropriate transition. We went from a very dark scene to something very lighthearted, but still kind of flirts around with dark matter, and it relieves us some pressure. We have a blank slate again. Now we have a new story. We're focused on solving a murder mystery. And I guess you still get a little bit of that, will he get away with this, or him and the mom get away with this? So yeah, now we're like in this true second act. It's almost like a sequel. So Vera Miles shows up as Lila, and it's cool. Again, visually, the rakes are pointed towards her like hands going out to reach for her. You would have seen her maybe in the Twilight Zone TV show. She was in the episode with Hitchhiker Situation and the one with the doppelganger. And I love this casting. I think they could definitely pass as sisters. So Arbogast walks in, and we get a hint that he's the next person that we're going to follow, because the focus gets close up on his face. So because they're doing this extreme close up and they're focusing literally so much on him, we think that that's who we need to focus on subconsciously. So it shifts us to thinking that this is the detective hero type, kind of like in a film noir type anti-hero thing, where he might be our new protagonist. We'll see how that plays out. Yeah, again, I love some of the details that come out. Anthony Perkins, amazing acting with the candy corn. He improvised that little habit of Norman's. Okay, so this is the same technique as a filmmaker that was used with Marion. We want Norm to get away with covering up for his mother because we realize how deeply he is affected by her. We feel sorry for him, just like we felt sorry for Marion. We don't want him to get punished by the mother or by the authorities. Yet at the same time, we want justice for Marion. So it's very complicated because you're on both sides, and maybe even slightly more so on Norman's. I don't know. What do you think?
Possibly. I feel like for me, after watching the whole debacle with him cleaning up the murder, I'm questioning it more myself. But I'm definitely not feeling like any kind of, I guess, strong pull towards Arbogast. I feel like Arbogast is kind of arrogant and like cocky in a way.
Right.
And so I'm not totally on his side. It's sort of like a lose-lose situation, at least for me. But I think that watching the confrontation of Arbogast at the Bates Motel with Norman Bates is just, it's money. I mean, those camera angles there,
the close-up shots.
Yeah. I mean, the infamous, I mean, I think you were the first one to point out how amazing that shot was of Norman sort of leaning over the table to look at the book. I'm doing it right now. And
yeah, literally craning his neck over.
Right. Yeah.
Again, kind of connecting them. The shots are beautiful and interesting, so unique. I've never seen anyone focus on that part of someone's anatomy before, like on the throat. It's really stunning. Yeah, so we notice that Arbogast is getting a little aggressive with Norman. And then again, we see that aggressive side of Norman come out, just like it did with Marion. So we kind of see that there's a trigger type situation. If he feels threatened, like something else will come out.
Or especially the mother. Like if,
right,
if this
definitely.
Mother feels
or his
threatened.
Mom.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, anything against the mom. So this creeps me out all the time. When Arbogast leaves, the inappropriate smiling and affect on Norman Bates's face gives me the chills. Unless you think he's smiling because he's relieved to have the detective go away, it's just, you see something off, or alarm bells went off for me in that moment. Okay. When he walks in, the feelings are so tense. He's walking up the stairs. The door to the mom's room is slightly creaking open at the same time, simultaneously. And then when the mother comes out and stabs him, to me, that's the biggest jump scare in this entire film. The first time I watched it, I thought I was going to die. I did not see that coming like that fast, like right then.
I literally just looked over my shoulders three times with constant chills going on, because that overhead shot of the mother walking out the door straight to Arbogast with that music is just, I just want to jump out of a window. Like,
so good.
It kills me. And to think that, I mean, again, such an effective camera shot. And then Arbogast kind of like comically falling down the stairs like a stooge, like, I mean, it's not funny, but like, I'd do anything to make the scene lighter.
I was going to say, it relieves me a little. I'm glad he made it a little hammy, because I was scared out of my wits. I didn't know that the door was going to open like right then, and or that she'd go for it.
So fast. And just like matter-of-factly, it is just straight up terrifying. I really don't know which is scarier between the shower scene and that one. It's a toss up for me, because I feel like depending on my mood, either one gets me. And so, yeah, I mean, ajar doors, RIP. Like I can't do it. But yeah, I mean, it's, God.
Well, it puts Lila and Sam in a conflict. So then what happens?
And so when Lila and Sam do not hear from Arbogast, Sam visits the motel. Sam sees a figure in the house who he assumes is Mrs. Bates, but she ignores him. Lila and Sam visit the local deputy sheriff, who informs them that Mrs. Bates died in a murder-suicide 10 years ago. The sheriff concludes that Arbogast lied to Sam and Lila so he could pursue Marion and the money. Convinced that some ill has befallen Arbogast, Lila and Sam drive to the motel. Norman carries his mother from her room and hides her in the fruit cellar.
Okay. Wow. Norman in the swamp again. When I see him in that swamp again, offing Arbogast cart, to me that just confirms that he's done this more than just the time prior.
Right.
Like, how much room is there in that swamp, for that matter?
I know. And just, are we going to find a bunch of cars down there? Are we going to have a little car dealership swamp action? What's going on?
Crazy.
But yeah, I mean, he's definitely got his little routine figured out.
Definitely. Okay. When they go talk to that sheriff, this is one of the best twists, definitely in this movie and maybe of all time. When it's revealed that Norman's mom died, just myriad questions come up.
Yeah.
The mother's boyfriend died, and from the earlier conversation, we know it was in a horrific way, according to Norman. And now we found out that the mom apparently died too. And then we hear it's a murder-suicide, like, but we think she's murdering these people still, because we get this track record as an audience of her killing people. The line of, if that's Mrs. Bates, who's that woman buried in Green Lawn Cemetery? Now, this is interesting, because that question is posed to us, and then we think that we need to find out who the real woman is that's buried. We think she's a murder victim, the one that was buried, and the mom is out there continuing her murderous riff.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. So at this moment, it seems like everyone as an audience is on board that the mom is still alive and that there is a victim buried in her place. But you have so many questions in your mind. And then we cut right to the scene with Norman taking his mom away. And I love that the initial conversation happens behind the walls. We still get that sense of mystery about him and his mother together. But I love that we get the camera panning all the way up to that bird's eye view that we had with Arbogast's death and seeing him carry his mom out from above. So this feels like a natural shot, because we've seen it before, and now we feel solidified in our belief that the mom is still alive, because we got that view of him and the mom together, even if it's not super clear. So that death of Arbogast was twofold. Yes, it was scary and shocking, but it also made this scene look more natural.
Mm-hmm. And for some reason, I guess as an audience viewer, you don't for some reason question the fact that this mother was healthy and fine enough to, you know, somehow go outside of the house to go down and kill Marion, also come out of the room to get Arbogast, but then needs to be carried down the stairs by Norman for some reason, unless something, I don't even know.
Or you think she's just like, you would think that she'd put up more of a fight.
Yeah, that she'd put up more of a fight to resist going down into the fruit cellar. The infamous fruit cellar.
You think I'm fruity, eh?
You think I'm fruity, boy.
I love that line.
I really hope whoever's, you know, listening to all of this appreciates that. But we love Mrs. Bates. But yeah, so So yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on here, but I mean, question marks are raised, but I feel like the action is, it's happening so quickly that we're not really questioning anything. We're just suspending any kind of disbelief that we have that's associated with it. So yes, anything else before we continue?
Oh, I'm ready. Let's go.
So after Norman brings his mother to the fruit cellar, Sam distracts Norman by engaging in a conversation at the motel, and Lila sneaks inside the house. Norman becomes agitated and assaults Sam. Lila hides in the cellar, where she discovers that Mrs. Bates has turned into a mummified corpse. After hearing Lila scream, Norman, wearing his mother's clothes and a wig, runs to the cellar with a chef's knife. Sam regains consciousness and manages to subdue him.
Okay, wow. So Sam and Lila had their safety in numbers, everyone, which I actually think was pretty smart. That should have been done
much sooner.
Yeah. So I love how Sam's like, looks like a bad day coming, and it's the sunniest sky ever.
I don't like the look of those clouds. Yeah. Sun is beaming down on him.
Right. And at that point, I think that Norman knows what's up, and I think he thinks they're in on it. What do you think? Yes, no.
Just I don't like the look of that sky. I mean, if I'm Norman and I have any like brain cells that are functioning, yeah, something's definitely up.
And we're back on the money thing. So now Lila's all, he wanted to steal the money. Now this is starting to feel like a social commentary on our society's preoccupation with capitalism or money over human lives. And okay. And then at this point, are you getting some romantic vibes between Sam and Lila?
Yeah, a bit. I could see that. I mean, it runs in the family. You know, the genes are close. But yeah, I'm definitely getting some mommy daddy vibes.
I am getting some romantic chemistry here, and what's odd about that is that in the book there is a romantic subplot with the Sam and Lila characters, but Alfred Hitchcock wanted to cut it from the movie to focus on solving the mystery. But I can still feel those undertones. I feel the tension there. And what's crazy is it's definitely confirmed in Psycho 2, the sequel. Sam and Lila did eventually get married.
I think like if there's a way to go about it, that's how it should be. Just like a subtle implication of a romantic yeah. relationship or, you know, possibility. But yeah, I mean, this entire sort of sequence is just magnificent. I feel like this climax just comes right. It's a right hook right to your jaw. And it, I mean, it escalates. It's so fast. When Sam gets knocked out, oh. I feel like, you know, all hope is gone.
You're like, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, we get some interesting stuff. I mean, Lila's sneaking about the house. I can't stand her being in that house. It scares me to death. We actually learn a lot about the mother when she goes into the room. I remember the first time I watched this, I thought it was very weird that there was such an indent on the bed. And it makes you feel like the mother lays there nonstop. But we've been seeing her walking around. So that's odd. And the mirror jump scare is pretty good too. I like that one. And what's crazy is Norman's room. It's full of toys and he has a small bed. It very much looks like a kid's room. And it's like one last punch to show that he's so innocent, childlike. When Lila sees Norman coming and heads down to the fruit cellar, oh my gosh, I love that scene. It is so suspenseful. I was on the edge of my seat. I feel like she's going to the lion's den. It is so scary. And then we see Lila in the fruit cellar walking up to the mother. And then...
that corpse.
Yeah, it's a mummy. Not like a mommy. It's a mummy, but it's Norman's dead mother.
That, yeah, I mean, this is it, folks. This is the huge sort of twist. It was never the mother, you know, killing Marion, killing Arbogast. It was Norman the entire time wearing the mother's clothes.
Yeah, he was wearing a wig and a dress the whole time. He's the murderer.
Yeah, he's the murderer. He's the one with this. He's the psycho. You know, he's quote unquote psycho. I don't know if it's like politically correct anymore to, you know, label him as a psycho, but he's a psycho. And he's got this, I guess, what do you call it? A split personality, or what would it technically be?
So we'll kind of get to the end here. So in the end, in court, a psychiatrist explains that Norman killed his mom and the lover over jealousy and that he has an alternative personality. So Norman has what we would call today dissociative identity disorder. So this is a mental health diagnosis, which is characterized by a mental process that produces a lack of connection from a person's thoughts, their memories, emotions, what they do, and sense of self. So dissociative identity disorder is thought to kind of stem from a lot of factors, which may include trauma experienced by the person with the disorder. Many people who've had trauma do dissociate, and the dissociative aspect is thought to be a coping mechanism where this person literally shuts down or dissociates themselves from the world around them because it's too much, too violent, too painful, too scary to go through as your conscious self. So this other self emerges, and you as your conscious self then don't remember the things in that moment. It is a real mental health disorder. It's a real diagnosis. A lot of things can play part in it. Environmental stressors, trauma, especially when you're a child, emotional abuse or neglect, which definitely lines up with Norman Bates, it sounds like. And as many as 99% of the people who have dissociative disorders have reported personal histories of recurring, overpowering, or life-threatening disturbances or traumas in childhood, usually before age 6. So that's Norman. Now, again, once again, everyone, I'm going to step on my pedestal. Mental health disorders do not make you a criminal. This is an unusual fictional account used for entertainment value. This does not characterize the vast majority of people with mental health diagnoses or mental health disorders or mental illnesses.
Thank you, Emma. Thank you. Needs to be said. But yes, I agree. I also, just what you said, you put it great. Yeah, I mean, this last final sort of scene really explains everything.
It's a good tie-up. Yeah. It's a good little package, tie up the strings. It feels very satisfying.
But also, I mean, just what an ending shot with Norman sort of in the jail cell with the fly and the voiceover of the mother and the car being towed.
The superimposed skull on his face of the mother showing that they're one and the same.
Amazing.
Beautiful, innovative, fantastic, amazing, whatever that Lady Gaga meme is.
It's great.
It's a perfect end. This is a perfect story to me.
Yeah.
I love this movie.
It really is. It's a fantastic, fantastic movie. I think one that is essential if you're an American to watch, and highly recommended if you're a citizen of the world. And so, I mean, everyone should watch it. But yeah, I mean, this is just such a fun one to revisit, to rewatch, and just to really get all those feelings again, because it's always this, from the first time you watch it to the most recent time. I feel like it's so close to what you feel, each viewing. And it really just can't be matched. So, Emma, what else do you have to sort of say before we kind of wrap it up here?
Wow, this is just a really important movie in cinema history. If you haven't seen it, I'm sorry for all the spoilers, but
definitely seen it. I mean,
but yeah, no, this is an incredible film. I feel so lucky that we have this piece of art to enjoy for generations and generations to come. It ages fantastically. I feel very fortunate to be able to see this movie because I think it really implements the best, most pinnacle, highest quality storytelling there is. So thank you guys so much. I know this was a little bit of a longer one, but I think this film definitely merits a little bit more time. I want to apologize that this is coming out a little later than our normally scheduled. I feel like I was living in a horror movie this week. I feel like we were navigating a lot of weird stuff. So thank you guys for being patient. Hopefully you guys got to check out The Shining or one of our other recommendations in the meantime. please reach out to us and continue a dialogue because, yeah, we love this film. We love all movies, and we definitely want to talk to you guys about anything that we might have missed. And thank you so much. We've gotten a couple recommendations for TV episodes or movies you guys want us to cover or check out. We will get on that and let you know when those are coming. So get excited for that.
Definitely. Thank you again for all the support as always. Please reach out on Instagram at Old Soul Movie Podcast or Old Soul Movie Pod on Twitter. We always love to talk to you. Always love to see what's going on in your life. We're definitely all in this together, Old Soul fam. And yes, if you loved this episode or loved Psycho, the movie, please give us a 5-star rating. Please share with a friend, someone who you think would either love this episode or just really enjoy it. Someone who would like listening to two knuckleheads, you know, just talk about old movies. We always really love and appreciate having you guys here. So thank you again, as always. And yes, let's continue this spook fest of October. Emma, do you have anything to say before we sign off?
No, just happy watching and enjoy this one.
Until next time, everybody, watch your shower curtains.